This is the Big E Sports Show
on the Sports Map Radio Network.
From the Sports Map Radio studios, here's Elissa Walker Campbell.
Hey, Elissa Walker Campbell. Welcome back. Sports Map Radio Network, the Big E Sports Show, of course, sponsored by Progressive Insurance. Round out your protection with Life Phone and Pet Health Insurance. Visit Progressive.com. Well, as promised in our next segment, it is time to tee it up. The 44th Ryder Cup. It is underway at Marco Simone Golf and Country Club just outside of Rome. And we are thrilled to have back with us former PGA pro and author. That is the great Larry Miller, who is actually at the course because I can hear those birds just singing away.
It's those great are my pet parakeets.
Hey, Larry, it's great to have you with us on this Saturday. So it is finally here. The Ryder Cup, it is underway. A lot of storylines that we want to get into. I know the American and the European players have been, you know, looking so forward to this. They want to hoist the coveted Ryder Cup trophy, and they want those bragging rights. So when this rolls around, I mean, what do you enjoy the most about this very special event?
Well, I think what makes it special, of course, is the teams are playing for their teammates, of course, but mainly for their country. And it seems to bring out a lot of emotion in the players that you don't otherwise see on a week-to-week basis. You know, they're playing as individuals in these tournaments week to week, and, it's all about business, you know, and it's all about them and playing the golf course. But all of a sudden now, you've got these teammates who that are relying on you and you on them. And then you add to that the fact that you're representing your country. You know, they get up there and play that national anthem, and boy, it'll bring out the goosebumps. And so it brings out the emotion in these players, and I think that's one reason that makes it so special. And also that it's only every 2 years, and so it's a big build-up to it, and everybody looks forward to it for a long time.
Now, Rory McIlroy said the Ryder Cup is the best event in golf. Do you agree or disagree?
I agree. I think it's the best team event in golf, for sure. I don't know, because of the patriotism involved and all that and the emotion, you know, it just makes it special. It's just different. It's kind of like a Super Bowl or something, and except it's every 2 years. But yeah, I would think that it's probably the most anticipated golf event that occurs, and certainly the one that elicits most of the, as I said, the emotion. And the players, which is fun to see because the fans, the general public, doesn't see that very often.
You know, I should ask you, you know, would you rather play the Masters or participate in the Ryder Cup? I mean, that was one of the debates going on this week on sports radio.
Oh, I think it would be a Ryder Cup, hands down, for sure. It's just so special, and to be on that team. And, yeah, I mean, that would be my vote. And Masters would be a close second, though.
Absolutely. Hey, we are going one-on-one with Larry Miller. He joins us each and every week as we go inside the ropes. He is a former PGA pro and author. Check out his website, LarryMillerGolf.com. Oh. And, of course, the United States, they are trying to win the Ryder Cup on the road, which would be the first time in more than 30 years. So if you are the captain, Zach Johnson, I mean, what is your message to your team, especially when you have so many players on this roster that have never experienced a Ryder Cup atmosphere? Because as we have seen it watching on television, I mean, these crowds can be overwhelming at times.
Well, I think that the players that haven't been there before are going to have to understand that they're going to feel emotions and pressure that like they've never felt before, and that what they need to do is they need to use that. They need to not have it affect their performance in a negative way, but they have to embrace that and take it up a notch because of it. That's the way you have to handle it. If you get awed by it or overcome by it emotionally, then it's going to affect your game. You're going to have more tension in your swing. And as we all know, tension in the golf swing is fatal. It's the worst thing that you can have. So I think explaining to the players that, look, here's what you're going to face, but what you need to do is embrace that, feed off of it, and just make that like I'm going to show them. You know, I'm going to show them what I can do despite this. And I think who's really good about that is a guy like Koepka, who feeds off of all that stuff.
That's true.
The adversity or negative comments. And you know, Patrick Reed was great about that, too. He played his best when all the arrows were firing at him, you know, and all the bad things were being said. He made him play better. But that's what you have to do, because I'll tell you, I'm a little worried about this Ryder Cup because the European team, they are a bit more emotional about this than the players, the American players, because the U.S. players don't, you know, they just don't have that same camaraderie and chemistry that the Europeans have had historically. And so that's what worries me is that, because listen, golf is like any other sport. It's a game of momentum. It's a game of, what happens is this, the emotion gets your adrenaline pumping, okay? Mm-hmm. And when your adrenaline is pumping, then you can either perform much better than you usually do, or it can just tear you apart. So it's important to be able to somehow mentally use it as an advantage because the emotion is going to run high. They're going to have fans, the European fans, yelling all sorts of things and making all kind of noise. But they have to try to use that as a weapon and not have it affect them negatively.
The 44th Ryder Cup, it is underway right now at Marco Simone Golf and Country Club in Rome. And, I mean, what you're saying is so true. I mean, the U.S. players, they have got to figure out a way to overcome those hostile European crowds. That's going to be critical. I'm just wondering, leading up to the Ryder Cup, as a player, how do you think they were preparing? Because how does one simulate that in practice? I mean, you got to figure out a way to stay in the present as much as possible and continue to execute hit shots. But also, I mean, are they piping in sound, you know, on the golf course to prepare them in front of these, as I had just mentioned, these hostile crowds?
I don't think so. I know the NFL does that.
With NBA practice. Does too. Yeah.
Yeah, but I don't think you do it in golf. You know, they're just going to have to deal with it, and that's why I'm concerned about it. I think that we have the better team because of our depth on the team that we have. You know, if you go through the first five or six players, they're pretty evenly matched. But then as you go deeper into the lineups, you know, we have a little bit stronger, a little bit more depth. And so I think that's our advantage. Now, how we handle the emotion of it, that's going to be the decisive factor for this. You know, it's going to be fun to see how it turns out. But you listen, we haven't won on foreign soil in 30 years, and there's a reason. And the reason is because the Europeans have found a way to play with more chemistry among themselves than the U.S. players have in the past. Hopefully we can learn to do that this time and turn this around.
Hey, former PGA Pro author Larry Miller with us here in Hour 2 at Sports Map Radio Network. And let's talk about the course, Marco Simone, this championship golf course. My first question to you is, Larry, have you ever played golf in Europe? And, you know, when we talk about this particular course, I mean, it's considered one of the continent's best. What are these players experiencing?
I have played in Europe. I have not played in Italy. But I have played, you know, a lot of other places. And this golf course, I've never played it, but from what I understand, the rough is going to be extremely difficult. They cut it to 3 inches, about, I think, 3 or 4 days ago, I heard, and they haven't cut it since. They're not going to cut it. And so the rough is going to be extremely penal. Also, you know, the Europeans get to set the course up the way they want because they're the host. They're going to set it up for accuracy. You know, for shot making and for accuracy, not for distance, which somewhat negates a little bit of the U.S. advantage. We theoretically and statistically, too, we tend to hit it a little further, but a little less accurate. So they set the course up to demand accuracy. Our players, the U.S. players, are going to have to find a way, if they have to gear it down, you know, to hit fairway finders and avoid that rough and stay in the fairway, I think we can win. Because I think if we're in the fairway all the time, I think we have the best players, and I think I think we'll prevail. But if our players spend, you know, 20% of the time in the rough there at that course, we're not going to win because it's going to be so penal that you're not going to be able to reach a lot of greens with your approach shot. So they're going to have, hopefully, and I'm sure they've covered this, of course, they've probably covered every base you can think of, but hopefully they understand that they have to hit it in the fairway, even if they're sacrificing 20, 30 yards.
Well, and that's going to, in my mind, determine who wins or who loses. I mean, accuracy is paramount because you are avoiding, as you're talking about, the deep rough, but also those fairway bunkers. I mean, I did have a chance to watch the flyover online, and there is a lot of fairway bunkers.
And interestingly, there's two drivable par fours on the golf course, which, you know, a lot of times there's one, maybe in a U.S. Open, and or in another major, but this one has two. In fact, I'm sure everyone's heard by now that Victor Hovland made a hole in one on a par four, a practice round.
He's so something else.
We'll take that. How about we take that in the singles matches? But Now, when you get a drivable par four, the problem with that is that usually those greens are so well protected with hazards or bunkers that you take a big risk when you try to knock it on the green on a par four when you can reach it. You know, they always defend the hole that way with bunkers or hazards, water, whatever. So it's going to be hard for some of these long hitters to really gear down and bite the bullet, you know, and maybe hit a hybrid into position for a little flip wedge into the green instead of trying to take a risk. I think if our long hitters rely on their long hitting, then we're going to have problems. So I just think, and you're right, we agree totally. I think the determining factor is going to be how accurate are we going to be off the tee in these matches.
We're going to step aside for a quick commercial break. Much more coming up at Sports Map Radio Network, the Big E Sports Show.
Working in the oil and gas industry requires that you have the best equipment available because every job counts. At Energy Well Fab, our goal is to manufacture the best oil and gas processing equipment for customers through hard work and commitment. We proudly stand behind quality products just as we have for over 30 years. From inside out, we promote excellence, precision, and dedication. These values are the foundation for our success and why we continue to progress and go unmatched in customer satisfaction, loyalty, and service. Contact Energy Well Fab for your oil and gas processing equipment needs at energywellfab.com.
You're listening to the Big E Sports Show on the Sports Map Radio Network. From the Sports Map Radio studios, here's Elissa Walker-Campbell.
Hey, Larry Miller with us. Hour 2, Sports Map Radio Network, the Big E Sports Show. Check out his website, LarryMillerGolf.com. We are continuing our conversation as we talk about the 44th Ryder Cup. And I want to shine the spotlight on the United States captain, Zach Johnson. He is someone that has truly exceeded expectations from his playing career. You know, of course, went to Drake University as a golfer. He's a Midwest guy. And he was not, I don't know if you know this, but Larry, he wasn't even the number one guy on the team. So what do you think has been the key to his success? I mean, he's a 12-time winner on the PGA Tour, including two major championships. I mean, 2007, he won the Masters, and 2015, the British Open, and played at the old course at St. Andrews in Scotland.
Okay, number one, he's talented. Okay. Number two, he was extremely hard worker coming up in first getting on the tour. Really worked hard on his game like you wouldn't believe. I mean, he was like Tiger Woods-esque with his work ethic. Third thing is, he's a real smart guy. And to give you an example of how smart he is, how about when he won the Masters and he caught a lot of flack for laying up on all the par fives? And everybody else was knocking it over the creeks,
right,
and
yep,
hitting it,
okay,
on the two.
Yeah.
And he laid up on every single par five that week. And guess what? He won the Masters. Now, that was, he caught a lot of flack for it, and people called him, you know, gutless, you know, and all this stuff. But guess what? He won. He had the green jacket.
Who cares? Yeah.
Yeah. So he's smart. He's a smart guy, hard worker, and of course, talented. Maybe not the most talented player in the world, but if you add the smarts and the hard work to it, guess what? The talent gets better, and that's why he made it. And he's never been a long hitter. He was, for a long time, he was probably the best putter on the tour, along with Brad Faxon. But I think in the latter years, his putting dropped off a little bit. But he was an unbelievable putter for a very long time. You know, and a consistent ball striker, consistent enough to hit a lot of greens in regulation. And when you're a great putter and you hit a lot of greens, you're gonna score really well, even if you don't hit it that far.
He's got a high golf IQ and obviously a fairway finder. But what are your thoughts on just how he has handled himself as the Ryder Cup captain? Just kind of weigh in on some of his picks and his selections.
Oh, I think it was spot on to me. I think, you know, as I said before, I think he went for chemistry on this team because he knows, again, it shows how smart the guy is. He knows that the strength of the Europeans is their chemistry and camaraderie. So he tried to match that and build that on our team with the way he made his picks. You know, for instance, Spieth and putting Justin Thomas in there with him. And he's got Scottie Scheffler and Sam Burns. And, you know, he's got a lot of buddies that are paired together. And what that does is it does two things. It creates chemistry on the team, and it makes the players more comfortable. When you're playing with a good friend, you're playing with more comfort and freedom than if you're playing with a stranger.
Well, you mentioned Scottie Scheffler. Of course, he's working with a new putting coach to fix some of the issues. And you're an instruction coach. You're an instructor. So what would your message be to him, you know, after watching Scottie Scheffler? I mean, what has been the biggest issue?
Well, he's made a couple of very minor changes. You know, he added a bigger grip to his putter to try to quiet the hands a little bit. And he's gripping down on the putter a bit to make it a little shorter for more control, and also put his eyes over the ball more so he can see the line better. It's little things like that. But the biggest thing is he just has to relax, not put too much pressure on himself on the greens, and just be himself and be natural. You know, great putters, it's a blend. It's a blend of mechanics, and it's a blend of art, you know, science and art. And you have to have a big, big part of it being art, because a lot of it is intuitive and feel and distance control. And then you work on your stroke to have a consistent stroke, but you match those two, and if you can putt well, if you can relax. Now, you can do all that, and if you tense up, it kind of ruins everything. So you have to find a way to breathe on the greens, you know, quiet your breathing, slow your breathing down so that your heart doesn't go too fast, and just relax and rely on your instincts. And I think if he does that, I think he'll, you know, listen, anybody on the PGA Tour is a good putter,
yeah,
but the elite players are great putters. And the way he strikes the ball, if Scottie Scheffler starts putting well, he might win 10 tournaments a year.
The 44th Ryder Cup, it is underway. And I have to say, Larry, I want you to share, you know, it's tough to not see players like Dustin Johnson, Sergio Garcia, Lee Westwood, and these guys not competing.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of great players that aren't on that team. You know, it's too bad you can't have 20 on the team, because you'd have another, you know, 8 or 10 great players on it. But you can't pick everybody. And what you try to do is pick the ones that are, you know, give you the best chance of winning at the time, who's playing the best at that time. And listen, Justin Thomas, you know, there's a lot of criticism for picking him. But look, the last few weeks, last few tournaments he's played, he's kicked it up, and he's looking like Justin Thomas again. So I expect him to play really well and kind of validate Zach Johnson, putting him on there.
Okay, and we already talked about Zach Johnson as a captain. What about Patrick Harrington, who is the captain for the European Ryder Cup team? What do you think about some of his selections and just this incredible lineup that they've put together?
Yeah, well, it's Luke Donald, but
yes.
Patrick is one of the vice captains. But Luke Donald is he's a former, a lot of people don't know this about Luke Donald. He's a former world number one player.
Yes.
A lot of people don't know that. They just, you know, and he's almost a mirror image of Zach Johnson. He's never been a long hitter at all. Probably hits it like Zach does, you know, 260, 70 range. He's a real technician and a real, you know, another thing about Luke Donald, did you know that he's an accomplished artist?
I did not know that. Okay.
Oh, yeah. He has paintings, fantastic talent for art, and he's a world class artist. He's also a real smart guy, and he built his game around accuracy and course management. You know, the real smart guys are great course managers, because they don't make a lot of mental errors when they strategize. And I think he and Zach Johnson are kind of alike in that regard. And so hopefully that'll rub off on our team. hope some of Jack rubs off and gets those guys to just find the fairways. Listen, if we find the fairways, we're going to win.
Hey, we are winding down our time. Former PGA Pro author Larry Miller has been with us here in Hour 2, Sports Map Radio Network, the Big E Sports Show. It's hard to believe 2023 is starting to wind down. My final question for you is, what does the future hold for Tiger Woods? How many times a year are we going to see him?
Boy, what a question that is. I hope we see him a couple of times, but I'm just not so sure, because, you know, as time goes on, those injuries and the effect of those injuries, it's not going to get any better. The process of aging, tends to make things hurt a little more. I just, I wouldn't be surprised, Big E, if we don't see Tiger Woods in any more majors. I wouldn't be surprised at all if he realizes that he just can't do it. I hope I'm wrong, because everybody loves to watch him. But I just have a bad feeling about it, that as the years go on, the months go on, that the injuries, their effects, just take too much of a toll. And, you know, trying to have to walk 18 holes on that leg has got to be excruciating at some point. And so we'll just have to wait and see. You know, you don't hear much. Everything is so private and guarded with him that nobody knows really what's going on. But at some point, I'm sure he's going to come out and say that he intends to try to compete a little more again, or he's going to hang it up.
Hey, good stuff. Larry, enjoy all the coverage of the 44th Ryder Cup, as I mentioned, is underway right now at Marcos Simón Golf and Country Club. And connect with our audience. Larry, when they go to your website, LarryMillerGolf.com, what are they going to find?
I've got a website where you can send me videos of your golf swing. I take a look at it, analyze it, and figure out, you know, how we can make it better. And then I'll get you on the phone and we'll talk about your swing, and I'll explain to you the things you have to do to make it better and give you some drills to reinforce that information. So it's a great way to improve your game without having to go anywhere.
Absolutely. Larry, enjoy this beautiful fall weather, and we look forward to connecting next week. Thanks.
Yep. You will recap the Ryder. Yep.
Absolutely. Stick around. Much more coming your way. The fastest 2 hours in radio, Sports Map Radio Network, the Big E Sports Show. We will be right back after this quick break.
Working in the oil and gas industry requires that you have the best equipment available, because every job counts. At Energy Wellfab, our goal is to manufacture the best oil and gas processing equipment for customers through hard work and commitment. We proudly stand behind quality products just as we have for over 30 years. From inside out, we promote excellence, precision, and dedication. These values are the foundation for our success and why we continue to progress and go unmatched in customer satisfaction, loyalty, and service. Contact Energy Wellfab for your oil and gas processing equipment needs at energywellfab.com.
You're listening to the Big E Sports Show on the Sports Map Radio Network. From the Sports Map Radio studios, here's Elissa Walker-Campbell.
Hey, we are back. Hour 2, Sports Map Radio Network, the Big E Sports Show. I'm your host, Elissa Walker-Campbell. Always love to connect with our audience at eRadio Sports. Info at eradiosports.com, podcastarena.com. And you can download our app, take us anywhere, anytime for all the latest sporting news and developing stories. And we are sponsored by Progressive Insurance. For a job you'll love, visit progressive.com/careers. Week 4, NFL news and notes. Our coverage continues, and we're delighted to have back with us. We're going to go inside the huddle and hit on a variety of teams, and that is Adam Kilgore, national sports reporter for the Washington Post. Hello, Adam.
Hello, how are you?
Hey, good to have you on the program. Thank you for asking, and we're going to lead off our conversation. Let's hit on the Commanders. They're going to face the Eagles tomorrow, noon Central Time kickoff. Of course, the Commanders are 2-1. Just what has been your assessment of Washington's season so far through these first 3 weeks?
Yeah, you know, I think they, you know, I've certainly offered some reason for optimism. I mean, optimism was the main theme coming into the year. Hope was the main theme coming into the year, just because they're no longer owned by Daniel Snyder. I think that carried over onto the field for the first couple of weeks. I mean, fans were, like, really excited in a way they have not been in a long, long time. The on-field, you know, big story has been Sam Howell, who, you know, took a step back last week against Buffalo, to be quite honest. You know, the defense held in against a very good Bills team for a while, and then Sam Howell more or less gave the game away by taking nine sacks and making some turnovers, you know, forcing plays once they got down. And so it's a big week for them, I think, to find out how, you know, Howell, who they're pretty excited about, bounces back against a good team after by far his worst performance so far.
Well, and let's have you weigh in on the development of this young quarterback when we talk about Sam Howell. He won his first 3 NFL starts, but as you said, a very tough week against the Bills. So how does he bounce back from this?
Well, I think he made a good start, at least publicly during the week, at his weekly appearance with the press on Wednesday.
Uh-huh.
He took great accountability. He said, look, you know, I'm a young quarterback, but the other team doesn't care and the scoreboard doesn't care, so I can't use that as an excuse. He basically said that's, you know, that's not who I'm going to be as a player going forward. It's not who I am as a player, and I'm going to do better. And so that's a good start. You know, and I think that sort of echoes and continues to sort of his attitude all along since he's been the starter. You know, teammates certainly like him and believe in him. You know, but the task is not going to get much easier against that Eagles defense, and especially the front seven and pass rush.
Hey, we're talking Commanders and Eagles, going one-on-one with Adam Kilgore from the Washington Post, specifically about the starting quarterback for the Commanders, Sam Howell, of course, sacked 9 times last week and threw 4 interceptions. Let's talk about the fact that he's got to get some better protection, yes?
That's true. That's definitely true. But also, I think, you know, some of those sacks, too, were on the quarterback a little bit. I think the Bills, you know, with a very experienced defensive game caller and Coach Sean McDermott, were able to confuse him and throw some looks at him that he, you know, didn't quite know how to respond to. And, you know, I mean, certainly nobody would watch this Commanders team and say the offensive line and pass protection is a strength. But I do think some of those sacks were incumbent on Howell to get the ball out quicker, to work through progression faster, to find a completion or a check down, rather than hang in the pocket or, you know, try to scramble and make something happen. So I think that's a big learning point, for him this week. You know, certainly again, you know, it takes a village for a sack sometimes and,
yeah,
and the line is not their strengths, but, you know, 9 sacks, you know, the quarterback's got to do something about that.
Commanders head coach Ron Rivera certainly has had plenty of experience developing young quarterbacks. What can you share in terms of what did they have Sam focus on in the offseason to kind of accelerate his growth?
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of it was working with new coordinator Eric Bieniemy. It's interesting. I mean, Ron Rivera has really handed over the offense to Eric Bieniemy. He came over from Kansas City. I mean, even Rivera's talked about how it's kind of the year's been a learning experience for him as far as, you know, letting Eric work and learning things from the way that Bieniemy is sort of conducting the offense after coming over from Kansas City. And so really, you know, the development of Howell is mostly in Eric Bieniemy's hands. And, you know, I think the focus really is just on improvement, on making sure that, you know, once he makes a mistake, he doesn't make it again. Bieniemy has been pretty complimentary about Howell as far as his learning, and that, you know, usually once he learns a lesson, he can improve and go on from there and not make the same mistake twice. And so again, that's why, you know, it's a really interesting week for him because he made a lot of mistakes against Buffalo, and, you know, can he improve after, you know, Philadelphia studies that film and, you know, tries to, you know, get him with the same concepts.
Mm-hmm. So, Adam, how is Sam Howell? How is he different than other quarterbacks that the Commanders have had in the past? I mean, like, how is he different than Carson Wentz?
Well, he's good.
Adam.
Yeah. No, but honestly, I mean,
right.
a big difference, I think, is, you know, Carson Wentz came in and, you know, I think he kind of rubbed teammates the wrong way. I don't think he was as accountable as Sam Howell has been. You know, I think Sam Howell is, you know, he comes in from like a big, you know, I think one thing is easy to forget about Sam Howell because he went so far in the draft. You know, he slipped to the fifth round. He was a big star in college. Like, you remember at Carolina, his sophomore season, so the year before his draft year, he could have been like, you know, he was expected to be after the year he had there. He was expected to be like a first round pick, potentially like a top 10 type of pick. I think he was preseason All ACC Player of the Year. He was the face of the UNC program, which, you know, it's not the biggest college football program, but it's not nothing. And then, you know, he kind of lost some complimentary players around him in his last season in college, and didn't put up as good a performance, and you know, has some minor injuries he played through, and slid down everybody's draft board, and all of a sudden he's a fifth rounder. But the idea of like being the focal point of a team, of an offense, is not new to him. You know, even on like a pretty big scale, even not NFL scale. And so I think that stands out. I mean, like being, to have the combination of youth and poise he has, that's new, because, you know, ever since the Kirk Cousins left for free agency, they've kind of cycled through veteran quarterbacks. And so, you know, what those guys were able to bring in professionalism or experience. They kind of lacked in ceiling and excitement. And I think Howell does have a lot of that for the fan base. And that will evaporate quickly, obviously, if he can't perform better than he did last Sunday. But for now, I think that he does provide, you know, a more interesting ceiling, a more interesting future than a lot of the players before him did at that position.
Yeah, I think this is going to be a fascinating matchup tomorrow. Commanders, Eagles, noon Central time, and certainly the Eagles are heavily favored in this matchup. But let's not forget, a year ago, Washington handed the Eagles their first loss of the season. Can they do it again?
Well, I wouldn't bet on it, but you're right. I mean, that is certainly something, you know, I think Jack Del Rio did a really good job, the defensive coordinator last year. The Commanders are somewhat built to frustrate Jalen Hurts because their defensive line is so good. They can mitigate that excellent Eagles offensive line, at least somewhat. It's more of a fair fight than most teams against the Eagles O-line. Del Rio really good schemes last year where he would kind of force Jalen Hurts out of the pocket and play zone behind it and make him throw on the run. I think what we've learned about Jalen Hurts, probably through that Commanders victory last year,
He's
really dangerous when he's running the ball. He's really dangerous from the pocket. He's not that great. He's not that kind of elastic, fluid athlete that can throw on the run well. So you get him moving and prevent him from taking off downfield, that's how you can win against the Eagles offense. Maybe the only way you can win, especially based on the way their running game has performed the last few weeks with the emergence of DeAndre Swift. And so that's what I expect the Commanders defense to try to do, is to be stout in the middle, you know, have some D-line stunts and movements to get Hurts out of the pocket without letting him escape past the line of scrimmage. I think that's going to be their best path to keeping this game close, because it's going to be tough for their offense. It really is against that defensive front. You know, Jalen Carter's been one of the best defensive tackles in the NFL instantly. One of the very best players on a team that went to the Super Bowl last year already. And so they're going to have their hands full on that side of the ball, so they need to keep Hurts and their running game in check.
Commanders, Eagles, noon Central time, kickoff tomorrow. Of course, our very special guest has been Adam Kilgore from the Washington Post. Check him out, and that is also give him a follow on social media at Adam Kilgore WP. Always a true pleasure. Thank you so much, and we'll talk to you again real soon. Thanks, Adam.
All right, thank you.
You bet. Stick around. Much more coming your way here in Hour 2, Sports Map Radio Network.
Working in the oil and gas industry requires that you have the best equipment available because every job counts. At Energy Wellfab, our goal is to manufacture the best oil and gas processing equipment for customers through hard work and commitment. We proudly stand behind quality products just as we have for over 30 years. From inside out, we promote excellence, precision, and dedication. These values are the foundation for our success and why we continue to progress and go unmatched in customer satisfaction, loyalty, and service. Contact Energy Wellfab for your oil and gas processing equipment needs at energywellfab.com.
You're listening to the Big E Sports Show on the Sports Map Radio Network. From the Sports Map Radio Studios, here's Elissa Walker-Campbell.
Hey, Elissa Walker-Campbell, welcome back. Sports Map Radio Network, the Big E Sports Show. We are so glad you are with us here in Hour 2. Always love to connect with our listeners at eRadio Sports. You can email the show info@eradiosports.com. And we make it so easy if you happen to miss Hour 1. You know what? My producer, Luke Mario, has uploaded each and every one of my interviews at podcastarena.com. And you can take us anywhere, anytime on a Saturday afternoon. Just download our app for the latest sporting news and all the developing stories. And we have had you covered talking some college football and NFL news and notes. But right now, we're going to shift gears. We are going to take time here in Hour 2 for a book review. And our next guest has produced an amazing book on the history of the pre-NFL. It is titled Gridiron Legacy, Pro Football's Missing Origin Story. And we are honored to have on the program for the very first time, that is the author, Greg Fisseri. Hello, Greg.
Hi, Alyssa. Thanks for having me.
Well, congratulations on your incredible book. Of course, the foreword has been written by Franco Harris, Pro Football Hall of Famer, and it is jam-packed with, yes, so many never-seen-before quality photos, hundreds of images and memorabilia, but it's the story that has never been told, and so perhaps it's the greatest sports story that's never been told. Was that the goal of the book?
It wasn't necessarily to tell the greatest sports story never told, though someone called it that, and that's very fun. And if people think that, that's wonderful. But I guess the purpose of it in my mind is to honor the heroes and the founders of pro football before the NFL. And many people don't know that there was such a thing, that there was 28 years of pro football before the NFL was founded in 1920, which started in 1892, not in Canton. It started in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So people say, well, why is the Hall of Fame in Canton? And it's, well, the NFL was founded there in 1920, but it sort of evolved from its early days in Pittsburgh and transitioned to Ohio and ultimately leading to the founding of the NFL there.
We are shining the spotlight on Greg Fisseri's brand new book. It is titled Gridiron Legacy. You can go anywhere online and pick up a copy, of course, talking about pro football's missing origin story. And so help us understand, I mean, why this has never been shared before. How did that happen?
It's a great question. I can't believe that it all fell to me, right? I mean, how... You can Google anything these days, it seems. And how can you Google and not understand how pro football started and it become our greatest sport? But I think part of the answer to that is it wasn't always our greatest sport. I mean, baseball, going back to our childhood days, was king. It was America's pastime. But at some point, it wasn't anymore. And that's a little debatable when that happened. My opinion is it happened after the baseball strike of 94. And a lot of baseball fans really got upset with the, perceived greed of the strike. No World Series that year. I even had a cousin who played for the White Sox that year, lost his chance to go play for in the playoffs.
Uh-huh.
They were great that year.
Yeah.
So at that point, culture was getting faster. Technology was coming. People started liking football better. And so all of a sudden, wait a minute, where'd that come from? And so, people thought, well, Super Bowl I, was that the start of pro football? That was 1967. Chiefs, Packers, no. That was just the merger of the AFL and the NFL, kind of like the PGA and LIV Golf these days, I guess. But going way back to 1920 was when the NFL was founded. However, people don't know what happened before that. It didn't just get fully formed out of the womb. There was a period of evolution, and not just teams, but pro football, the beginning is defined by the person who was first paid individually to play, and that was all sort of thought to be unethical in the early days. So that's why it was never really known and understood. It was because it was hidden. It was under the table. And somebody in Pittsburgh, it turned out, according to an accounting ledger for a pro team there called the Allegheny Athletic Association, well, mm-hmm. really they were an amateur team, but they decided to pay a Yale All-American named William Pudge Heffelfinger $500, which was huge, to play one game to beat their rival Pittsburgh Athletic Club. But Pudge, never admitted it, so... This accounting ledger wasn't discovered until the 60s when the Hall of Fame opened, and they really went on a mission to document how this happened. It was known that the first pro teams were in Pittsburgh in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and but not who the first player was. So this accounting ledger, it's always, the accountants are always at fault. They get nailed for mm-hmm. documenting this payment, but... the AAU, that's still around today, the Amateur Athletic Union, big in junior basketball, they sanctioned amateur clubs to play national competitions in several sports. And if your club paid anybody, then you were banned from the AAU. So that's why it was all hidden and sort of not very well known at all for over 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
But slowly the You know, the dots have got connected over time, and but the real full narrative of the era was lost because of an alleged gambling scandal similar to the Chicago Black Sox, as they were nicknamed in 1919, that lost the World Series on purpose and took, you know, a bribe, several of the players. The movie Eight Men Out and Field of Dreams highlighted that story. A similar thing happened in pro football in 1906, and it ended the pre-NFL era in infamy, and I think really caused the story of the founders and pioneers of pro football to be lost. And that's really the heart of the story, and fell to me because my great-grandfather was the captain of the world champion Massillon Tigers in that year.
And he was from Pittsburgh, yes. Mm-hmm.
And he was from Pittsburgh, played his first professional ball there in 1901, 1902, and then got recruited when pro football failed in Pittsburgh financially. The teams just weren't making any money. So they kind of stopped playing and went back to amateur. And the Massillon Tigers wanted to beat the Canton Bulldogs at any cost. So they recruited him and three of his teammates to come out to play for Massillon. And that kept pro football going in Ohio and really took off until 1906, and when this scandal happened. So the photo collection I inherited through my family is very special, and it was really the inspiration for me to research the narrative to accompany the photos and put this coffee table format book at the suggestion of the great folks at the Pro Football Hall of Fame in Canton.
It's great.
They told me, yeah. I really had something special, and it was worth doing because it was very unique.
We are quickly going to run out of time. Our very special guest is Greg Fasera. He is the author of his new book. It is titled Gridiron Legacy, and I don't want time to get away, so kind of tell us, how did you structure this? What is the layout of the book? What are our listeners? What will they find?
They'll get a very heartfelt foreword from Frank O'Hara at the beginning, who I met working in Pittsburgh at the Heinz Sports Museum there. He was a huge historian and fan of my project. So he gets a great inspiration, you know, sort of for why it's important to him and other people. I give a quick, fun history of, like, the origins of ball games, football, you know, in the early, you know, going back to soccer, evolves into rugby, evolves into American football, just so there's a little backstory. But ultimately, I lay out, you know, the first era of pro football in Pittsburgh, how it transitioned to Ohio, putting names to faces with all these photos, and then really digging into the drama of the rivalry between Canton and Massillon, and how it led to the scandal and the death and then resurrection of pro football in 1915 with Jim Thorpe in Canton again, that led to the founding of the NFL there.
Mm-hmm. Hey, we want to encourage all of you listening today to go out and get a copy. The holidays are just around the corner. It's just an amazing and epic journey. Gridiron Legacy. Yes, there was professional football before the Super Bowl era and before the National Football League even existed. And he has chronicled, he has put it all together. It is beautiful for your coffee table and a wonderful gift. As I said, the holidays are going to be here before you know it. So Greg Fasera is our very special guest and author. And Greg, we will extend an invitation back to you. We just flat out ran out of time, and we will talk some more, okay?
Thanks very much, Alyssa. It's been a pleasure.
A big thank you to all of our guests and our lineup. We'll see you next weekend for the biggest, the best in sports, the Big E Sports Show. So long, everybody.